Okay, so we'll go ahead and get started. And let me first, since I asked all the teachers to read the announcements, I should probably read the announcements first too. So we have a back to school pool party on August 6th, and that's in Ellisville, so at the Edge Aquatic Center. Obviously continuing Sundays in the summer. So for this week, for the next 3 weeks, I think, through August 10th. So I think there's three more weeks of classes, so that's why you're all here. Great to see you all. Student Ministry is having a Friday Night Live event this Friday. So I think they're just doing pizza, movies, games, hanging out. So if you have middle or high school students, definitely check that out. Are still in Student Ministry. So the launch camp is August 8th through the 11th. So if you have middle school students, and I think that's even students entering into sixth grade would be a part of this. Make sure you sign up by deposits are due July 16th, but I think you could probably still get in there if this is still in the announcements. And then last, the merge pool party. We have a lot of aquatic events towards the end of the summer, which I can't really relate to because I hate the pool. But that is, at the McAtee's pool in Labadee. So if you're a college-age student, 18 to 25, I think, is that range. So definitely talk to Eric Grant to get the details on that. So I also will just get going because I gotta be honest, I feel like I never have a good handle on how much material I have, and I have never once in the history of teaching a class ever run out. So we might as well go ahead and just get into it. This is a class Awakened, going through the life and ministry of Jonathan Edwards. I'm encouraged to see all the people here. I'm glad this sounded like something that was interesting to you. So hopefully over the next hour, it'll be a good peek into the life of Jonathan Edwards. So this is kind of where we're going today. I like to do this just to kind of give you something to hold on to as we go through here. So I'm going to start with just an introduction, overview of, just Jonathan Edwards, church history in general. We always have to give some kind of background to, kind of place us in church history. So we have to talk about the Puritans a little bit. And then spending most of our time in Edwards' life, his early life, and then his primary ministry in Northampton. And then we're going to kind of just wrap up with some, kind of where do we go now thoughts. Let's just go ahead and, actually I'm ahead of schedule, so let me go ahead and pray before we get going. Lord, thank you for this morning. We're just grateful that you have gathered us all together here at New Community as your people, that we might spend time worshiping you, singing praises to your name, sitting under the teaching of your word through the preaching of Pastor Rich. I just pray that you would bless our time this morning. Pray that it would be fruitful for us here, that we might learn from the example of one of your faithful men in church history, being Jonathan Edwards, and just as that we go out from here today, we might be able to take some of these lessons with us. They might impact our lives, that it might spur us on to continue to seek your glory in all things. Again, Lord, we're just grateful for all that you've given us. We pray these things in your name. Amen. Okay, so first introduction, as well as a brief justification of why we study dead, distant men. I don't necessarily have to make this an apologetic because you're already here. I guess you could get up in the middle and leave, so please don't do that. But the way our church history class, the church history class that I took started, was sort of a couple, they took some time to talk about why do we study church history. I was able to teach a church history class about a year ago, and I kind of started it in a similar way. I won't go into that, at length, but really two things just to consider of why we're here doing this. And the first being, most modern evangelicals are clueless about church history. And I don't say that as a slight to anybody, but I think that really is the reality. We think about all of the things that, even at our church here, the things that are emphasized, they're all very good things, preaching of the word. We do a lot of classes on Bible, Christian living. Church history kind of takes a side note, and it's really not just here. It's really everywhere in, really the modern church, especially in America. So I think that's one of the reasons why we really should lean in and we should seek to understand this better is because really, a lot of people just don't know a lot about church history. And then maybe a second example or a second kind of proposition to consider is that, we have much to learn from those who walked with God. I have on here Hebrews 11. We see the biblical principle of in Hebrews 11, we're seeing through this like hall of faith. We're seeing the examples of the faithful men who came before them who came through, you know, the Old Testament. But I think we can do the same thing even throughout church history. We still see these examples of the faithful men that God used to continue to advance his gospel in his church. And I think that we have a lot that we can learn from them, even though they're not, you know, at the forefront of our mind. So two things, I think, kind of just giving some reason why I think this class is important and why I'm glad that you're here. So the second thing, maybe why Jonathan Edwards specifically? I mean, we could have picked from any number of people for this class this morning. And, you know, there are a number of choices. And, you know, so in some sense, it's just I had an interest in Edwards, and I think he's a great example. But he is considered by many to be one of the greatest theologians ever, certainly one of the greatest American theologians. And so I think if we're going to pick just one during this study, he's definitely a good one. And I think as you read, as we'll read today, as you think about his life and just some of the circumstances of his ministry, you know, he is that example of commitment to calling even through trial and difficulty. And we'll get into that a little bit towards the end. But I think for those reasons, he's a great example, a great subject for this morning. So kind of our approach for today, I tried a new note thing. I'm seeing that the bottom is a little cut off here, but we'll see if that becomes a problem. So our approach, kind of two pieces, because I also understand that names, dates, locations, people, it can be dry. It can be tough to get through. So I certainly want to do that. I want you to know when Jonathan Edwards was born, when he started his ministry, things like that. But what I'm hoping we can do is spend more on that second piece of literary reflection. So there's a lot of pieces from his writings that I've included in your notes and we're going to have on the screen. And I'd really like to just take some time to read those, let you think about them, kind of respond to those, because I think that is really a helpful insight into who Jonathan Edwards was to actually, you know, read, you know, what he thought. So, and just one more thing too. So actually, if we need an example for us, this is from Jonathan Edwards in his biography on David Brainerd, which we'll talk about that a little bit more. But he says this. He says, "There are two ways of representing and recommending true religion and virtue in the world. The one by doctrine and precept, the other by instance and example. God also in his providence has been wont to make use of both of these methods to hold forth light to mankind and inducements to their duty in all ages." So I think even Edwards himself is saying, look, we are brought to light true religion and virtue through doctrine, but also through the example and instance of people who've come before us. So we're kind of even doing that even this morning in his life. Does anybody have any questions before we kind of get into the meat of things? Anything? I'm looking at my time code. We're way ahead. So we got plenty of time here. So as I said, with church history, kind of the struggle is always, how do you just dive into something? How do you get into the middle of somebody who's separated from us by hundreds of years without really, maybe you say the Puritans and don't even really know what that means or who that is. And so we have to give some kind of background to this this time period and kind of what was going on in the history of Christianity to really help set him and his life better understand what he was thinking. So we'll talk about the Puritans, kind of the... the 30,000-foot overview of how Christianity came to America. I was able to teach that class about a year ago, kind of on the first 12 to 1,300 years of church history. I would love to teach another one in the future on kind of that next piece. And so if this is interesting to you, this is just going to be very high level, but hopefully we'll be able to get into it in a little more detail at a future date. So kind of these three, if we have to divide it somehow, kind of these three big chunks here. This is kind of the medium short answer to kind of, you know, bring us to this point. So starting with I think many of you are familiar with the Protestant Reformation. So a movement in Europe in the early 1500s where men like Martin Luther post his 95 Theses in Germany, Ulrich Zwingli, he's doing ministry in Switzerland, 1536 Calvin in Geneva. So these are the men who are seeking to spark the Reformation. They've seen a lot of things creep into Roman Catholicism in their day, and so they said, hey, actually, we think that being faithful to what the scriptures teaches, what the Bible teaches, is what's most important, and so you get the ministries of these men. You've probably heard of Martin Luther, maybe not so much Ulrich Zwingli, but John Calvin, probably for sure. So that's happening in mainland Europe. In 1534, Henry VIII, maybe that sounds somewhat familiar to you, Henry VIII becomes king in England, And at that time, the Church of England is Catholic, but Henry has a problem. He unfortunately wants to divorce his wife, and he's not allowed to do that according to the Catholic Church. So instead of, you know, sticking it out and reconciling, he instead issues the first act of supremacy in England, which basically says, no, I'm actually the head of the church in England. We're Protestants now, so I can go ahead and do this with my family. So it's not a great, you know, piece of church history. It doesn't shed the best light on that, but that's how it was. And so now we start to see this break in England from the Catholic Church. And, you know, moving then into this like mid to late 1500s, you kind of see this back and forth. It really kind of depends who's the ruler of England at the time. You know, in 1553, you have Mary the First. So if you've heard people talk about Bloody Mary, that would be Mary the First in 1553. And she kind of switches the tables back, and she's, you know, more allegiant to the Catholic Church. And really you see this reign of persecution that's coming up against these people who were, you know, against the Catholic Church, who were more on the Reformed side. And during her reign in 1553, that period, 1553 to 1558, you see a lot of these Christians who are being persecuted by this Catholic rule in England. They flee to mainland Europe. So they just say, okay, well, we're just going to leave then, and we're going to go to mainland Europe. And as they're there, they start to pick up on Reformed theology. So we just talked about Calvin and Luther and Zwingli. So when these people migrate from England to mainland Europe, they start to pick up on these things. And it's not until 1558 where Elizabeth I, now she becomes the Queen of England, and she issues the second act of supremacy. So she says, okay, once again, I am now the supreme ruler and head of the Church of England, and we are, you know, separating from the Catholic Church. And that's really kind of where you start to see the Anglican Church really kind of start to take form. So if you've heard of the Anglican Church, that is the Church of England. And she reigns for, you know, almost 40 years. And so then you start to see this migration back. Now that Mary the First is no longer queen, we have Elizabeth the First, who is, you know, she's more sympathetic towards Protestant Christians. And so you start to see this, you know, migration back. And so for the next 100 years, let's say, so 1558, Elizabeth I becomes queen. And for the next 100 years, you see the Puritans, they're seeking to purify the Anglican Church of its Catholic roots. So even for some of these Puritans, they're saying, well, I know that we are separated from the Catholic Church, but there's still a lot of these elements that are just, they're a little too Catholic for what, you know, we think is faithful to the scriptures. And so they sought to kind of purify that, continue that movement through the Church of England. And that kind of gets us to the early 1600s. That continues again for about 100 years. And so in 1603, King James I, he was James VI of Scotland, he becomes the king in England. And so everything's, well, great. You know, there's a Scottish Presbyterian who now is, you know, becoming the king of England. This should be perfect for, you know, Protestantism. Ultimately, it doesn't quite go that way. And he really kind of ends up committed to the Anglican Church, things like the Book of Common Prayer. What you kind of have to keep in mind at this time, there's only one church in England. There can only be one church in England by law. If you go to a church, it has to be the Church of England. And if you go to the Church of England, the Anglican Church, you have to use things like the Book of Common Prayer. It's very regulated under the rule of the head of the Church of England. So there really wasn't a lot of wiggle room. And ultimately that leads to this group of Puritans who are trying to purify the church, saying, okay, well, we'll flee again. And then they end up fleeing that persecution to the New World, being mainland America. So that kind of gets us into the early 1600s, which is getting closer to where we're at in Edwards. But just, I hope that kind of paints this picture of, yeah, again, how we kind of get to the time of Jonathan Edwards and that track of church history of, you know, how do we end up with Protestants in America? Well, that's roughly kind of how that happens. So any questions? Any thoughts? All right, so now let's actually start talking about Jonathan Edwards, now that we've kind of set him in history. So first we'll get into Edwards' early life and how a spider-loving teenager became a devoted follower of Christ. And we'll, if you know anything about Jonathan Edwards, you may know this spider-loving piece here, but we'll talk about that in a minute. But So Edwards was born in 1703, and he was born in East Windsor, Connecticut. So again, when we think about where, even geographically, we're in New England, East Coast. I mean, that kind of makes sense what we remember about church history, or American history too, if that's really what there was at that time. So he's born in 1703. Both his father and his grandfather were both ministers. So he came from really a line of preachers. His grandfather, so his mother's father, Solomon Stoddard, is going to come up a little bit later in our discussion. He's a pretty significant figure as well in this time period. Edwards was one of 11, and more than that, he had 10 sisters. So he's kind of right in the middle. I think it was 4 younger, 6 older. And if you listen to anybody teach about Jonathan Edwards, or you know read anything, you'll always hear people talk about how they would say of Timothy Edwards, so Jonathan Edwards' dad, that he had 60 feet of daughters, because I guess his siblings were all very tall. So if you think about it, he's got 10 sisters, they're all about 6 feet, he's got 60 feet of daughters. So it's kind of just one of those things that you hear it all the time when they talk about Edwards, so I'm passing that to you. So Edwards was very smart. He lived in a post-Enlightenment world. So there's this emphasis really just in society, in the culture, around natural sciences. And so that kind of leads him to really get interested in studying spiders, of all things. And even so much that he submitted his work to, the Royal Academy of Science. So it's kind of one of his, you don't think about many, 10, 11, 12, 13-year-olds studying something so intently, submitting it to one of the, premier science journals of the day. But that was who he was, very bright, very, very interested in certain things. And so it says on here in 1716, he enters Yale. So he's 13 years old, and that seems very early. And it was early, probably not quite as early as we're thinking. Typically in that day, in the 1700s, kids or students are going to college roughly when you'd enter high school. So 13 is young, but not like, whoa, now we're 18 and we go to college. He graduates top of his class in 1720. And it was around that time, Edwards has a sort of near-death experience. He has this severe sickness. And, that was kind of right towards the end of his college year. So in the, 1720 span of time. And that's really the beginning of his spiritual awakening. And it's during this season that he begins to read his Bibles, learn more of God, really dive into the study of God's sovereignty. That was a doctrine very close to him. I think even as we talk later about what he wrote on, what he published on, it will be very clear that that was something that was very, very important to him. And so during this season, kind of after his conversion, so in the 1722, 1723, span of time, Jonathan Edwards wrote 70 resolutions, and maybe you've heard of this. If you've heard of any of Edwards' writing, there's a couple things. I'm trying to highlight some of those. This maybe is one of those that you've heard, his 70 resolutions that he sought to keep as evidence of his conversion. Now, I think when we start to talk about this, we don't want to get the sense that he had this list of things that he felt he had to do to demonstrate that he, took to earn his salvation. It's not that at all. It's not, more of this Arminian thought of I have to do this to be saved kind of thing. And when we read them, I think you'll see that. It really was just a man wanting to demonstrate his devotion and love for God. And this was just the detailed, oriented way that he could do that, he could, have these things to really devote his time and attention to. So let me try to change my text size here. Ooh, that's the wrong way. Oh, that was the end. Okay. So what I'd love to do, and I think you guys have this printed in your notes. So we're going to read just a couple of them, and I'll read them out loud. You can look at them on your notes. I'm really curious, for this one, like what sticks out to you in this? Or really even, when you read this, how are you challenged by what Edwards is writing? So he says, "Resolved that I will do whatsoever I think to be to the most, or to the glory of God and my own good, profit and pleasure in the whole of my duration, without any consideration of the time, whether now or never so many myriads of ages hence. Resolved to do whatever I think to be my duty and most for the good and advantage of mankind in general. Resolved so to do whatever difficulties I meet with, how many soever and how great soever." You'll notice, this is like 1700s English too, so I even like stumble over reading this. You have to read things a couple of times. But what sticks out to you from this? With that background of what this is, How does this sit with you? Any thoughts? We all think about this every morning when we wake up, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if I know when he, when he lived. Yeah, he's 22, you know, yeah, or he's in 19 or 1722, so he's born in 1703. So yeah, he's not even 20. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. A couple more here. That was resolution one, too. So that was right at the top. That's the first thing on his mind. That was resolution one. This is resolution seven and then 21. Resolved never to do anything which I should be afraid to do if it were the last hour of my life. And then 21. Resolved never to do anything which if I should see in another, I should count as a just occasion to despise him for or to think any way the more meanly of him. What about these? What is this? How is this helping give a better picture of Edward's faith, or even just faith in general? You know, what do we think about these resolutions? Anybody? Never to do anything which I should be afraid to do if it were the last hour of my life. Are there things that there are definitely things that I do that if it was the last hour of my life I would not be doing them? Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I agree. Yeah. We'll do one more here. Actually, two more. Resolution 27 or 28 and 57. Resolve to study the scriptures so steadily, constantly, and frequently as that I may find and plainly perceive myself to grow in the knowledge of the same. Resolved when I fear misfortunes and adversity to examine whether I have done my duty and resolve to do it and let the event be just as Providence orders it. I will, as far as I can, be concerned about nothing but by my duty and my sin. I think it's going to be but my duty and my sin. I was reading these and man, the second one too, I think about even just in our culture today, the idea of worry and all the things. And I mean, Haley would tell you, I definitely worry about things. I think what Edwards is saying here is like, hey, I need to think about what's happening in my life. Have I done what I can do to prevent or remedy or whatever? And if I have, I need to not worry about the rest of that. I need to, again, as he says, let the event be just as Providence orders it. I think, again, looking to this bigger picture of God's sovereignty, even he realized all the events of his life, if he's done what he can, ultimately God's sovereignty will rule over all. So any last thoughts on any of these resolutions? Yeah.
Is your teaching about church history, he has been, I mean, when you read his life,
uh-huh.
He's been attributed to as one of the contributing factors for the Great Awakening.
Uh-huh.
So there's one thing to write down, just like when we make resolutions in the New Year.
Mm-hmm.
There's one thing to live it.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
who has been a significant factor for that Great Awakening. We also read something about his life, that he was fired by the Church of the Northampton for standing for what he think was scriptural. That says a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I can write all these things in my heart and say, look, these are nice things, these are good jargons, and I can
mm-hmm.
do it, but in writing. But whether I would be able to live it accurately as I have written it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Maybe you should be up here teaching this class. Maybe you should be up here teaching.
No,
we're going to get to all those things. Yeah, I mean, that you're exactly right. Yeah. I don't want to give this list and then put up this picture of Jonathan Edwards as a man who was perfect in all regard. I didn't post this, but there's a blog article that, again, my church history professor wrote at, you know, years and years ago going through Edward's diaries and just seeing the struggle that he did have keeping these things. It wasn't like he made this list and said, yep, I'm done. This is I'm perfect. I do all these things. You know, he did experience the struggle and desire of wanting to do them and yet falling short. And I think that's just ultimately consistent with his theology of realizing that ultimately, you know, success in these things comes from God. Success in these things only is achieved by the power of the Holy Spirit in us. So was there something else back here? Or?
You basically summed it up.
Okay.
Uh-huh. He knows that he's already counting the cost.
Yeah.
Knowing that it's very steep, but it's also very worth it.
Mm-hmm.
For him, it's very, like, honest and bold and say, okay, all of these misfortunes that aren't going to happen,
yeah,
I'm choosing right now to set this precedent and this challenge that, like you said, by God's strength, I will uphold these. And you see that in the rest of his life in many different aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Well, yeah, so we're flying through here, so I would love to engage on some of these things even more. We got plenty of time. There'll be no issue of that. So that kind of brings us up to, you know, again, Edward's early 20s in that early 1720s time frame. So the majority of our time here this morning, I think, will be spent on his ministry in Northampton. So and you know, also then how the Great Awakening shaped the lasting legacy of Jonathan Edwards. So as Ruben mentioned, that's a big part of Jonathan Edwards' life and kind of his claim to fame, the name of this class. So let's go ahead and get into that. So before we move to Northampton, I guess the way I organize this is first kind of his early ministry. So right as he gets out of college, becomes a Christian, has this spiritual awakening in his own heart, 1722 to 1724, he's a supply preacher in New York and Connecticut. So really that just means, you know, he's supplying preaching to, you know, empty pulpits in New York and Connecticut. So getting a lot of experience preaching in different churches during this time. And ultimately in 1724, he returns back to Yale as a tutor. So again, we mentioned before, he's very bright, very intelligent, driven. So, you know, that's, he takes a break from preaching and goes back to his alma mater and begins to teach there. And so then February 15th of 1727, I don't have the date on there, but it's February 15th of 1727, Edwards is ordained as assistant minister in Northampton. So Northampton's in Massachusetts. And this was a church pastored by his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard. So it's actually, I mean, I think that's kind of cool that you know, he has that familial legacy where he goes back and he's able to work and serve with his grandfather, which actually, I guess that is a picture of him there, of Solomon Stoddard. Northampton was the second largest city in Massachusetts at that time, behind Boston. And so, you know, that kind of just helps to give a size and scale to the church. This was a pretty good sized church for its day. So Edwards comes on in February of 1727 as the assistant minister at that church. Later that year, he marries Sarah Pierpont, and I think that they met in college, or they'd been together they had a relationship for some time, 3 or 4 years, and then they're finally married in 1727, and she's also pictured here. And in 1729, his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, passes away, and so that then makes Jonathan Edwards the senior pastor of the church in Northampton. And so that kind of is that's the beginning mark of the main piece of Jonathan Edwards' ministry. And so in the early 1730s, there is this season of revival in Northampton, Massachusetts. This is kind of, you know, again, the first piece of his ministry, and it really is in response to Edwards' preaching. So he spends a lot of time preaching against Arminianism, and one of his well-known sermons from that time, I should have written down what year he preached it, and I could look that up for you later if you're curious, is a sermon titled God Glorified in Man's Dependence. And so we'll look at just a couple pieces from that. And this sermon was preached from the text of 1 Corinthians 1, 29 through 31. And so that text says this, if you're not familiar, off the top of your head. So in 1 Corinthians 1, 29 through 31, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God, and because of him you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God, righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. And so with that kind of in mind, this is the text that Edwards is preaching on. This is just one piece, and it's, man, we could do classes and classes really just going through all of the material in these sermons and his writings. It's just, you know, we kind of have to parachute into pieces of this, but I think there are a couple, what I've tried to do is pull out pieces that really do capture the essence of what he's preaching on, what his point is. You might see some, you know, ellipses in here where I've kind of cut some pieces out. It's not to make him say something he didn't say. It's just you could fill screens and screens to get to the full point. So I hope that, you know, these kind of capture that. But so this passage, so much the more men exalt themselves, so much the less they will surely be disposed to exalt God. It is certainly what God aims at in the disposition of things in redemption, if we allow the scriptures to be a revelation of God's mind, that God should appear full and man in himself empty, that God should appear all and man nothing. So what's the heart behind a thought like this from his preaching? Just from everything that we've talked about. I mean, why does he preach something like this? What do you think he's trying to really communicate to people who are listening?
To deal with men's pride?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
So what the context of revival,
mm-hmm.
was there any perceived crisis in the Puritan churches at that time?
Yep. So we will get to that when we will get to that. So if I could put a pin in that just for a minute. But yes, there are some circumstances that kind of brought forth the need for revival. So it's kind of similar to, you know, we saw in the church in England, this need for revival there. It's not quite exactly that same thing, but yeah, we'll get to that. If I could just hold off for a minute on that. Any other thoughts on this passage here from Edwards' sermon? Any thoughts? Okay, how about we'll do one more here. Again, still from God Glorified. See, this is why you need the clip. Because then when you hit it off your back. God Glorified in man's dependence. So faith abases men and exalts God. It gives all the glory of redemption to him alone. It is necessary in order to saving faith that man should be emptied of himself, be sensible that he is wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Humility is a great ingredient of true faith. He that truly receives redemption receives it as a little child, as in Mark 10:15, whosoever shall not receive the kingdom of heaven as a little child, he shall not enter therein. What do you guys think about this idea here that Edwards is preaching where he says humility is a great ingredient of true faith? Have you thought about that? Why do you think that he makes this point? That humility is a great ingredient of true faith.
Wretched sinner before a holy God.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Anybody else?
Well, he wrote the sermon, sinners in a hand of an angry God.
Yeah. Yep. We're going to get there too. You guys are on it. Everybody's on it. That's good. I'm glad we're on the same page.
Who's the main authority?
No, I mean, I think all of those pieces, even culturally, come together to definitely play a part in that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm.
It's God alone. In the previous passage, how he mentions God, I mean, helplessness of a child and total dependence on the parent and the father. I think he's clear in his thinking about what he resolved and what is written here.
Yeah, agree. Anybody else? Any thoughts on this? It's again, I actually don't know. Surely it must be. I think the good thing about church history, when you get to this era, a lot of this stuff you can find on the internet. And so definitely would encourage you, because it's hard to really capture the whole of this sermon, but just as it's titled, God Glorified in Man's Dependence, we're talking a lot about man's dependence, which is true, that is what he's trying to say, but it is to what end? It is to God's glory. That's, I think, what really comes out when you read the whole section. And you know, the Puritan preaching is, I wish I had brought one of my things. It's very divided. So you get, you know, doctrine and then application, kind of in these two pieces. And it's really the doctrine section for him is just this whole explanation of just like how God is glorified when we depend on him, that ultimately is designed in that way because he receives the most glory in that arrangement. So it's very good. It's not, some of his works, which we'll talk about, are very long and they are very challenging, at least for me to read. His sermons are very accessible. I mean, you could read one of his sermons in, you know, 15 or 20 minutes, and I would definitely encourage you to do that. So that's kind of the beginnings of his ministry in Northampton. And so we've talked a couple of times, alluded to it. Maybe in the future I'll think about how to arrange this material so this comes out sooner. But in the period of the 1730s, 1740s, that is known as the first Great Awakening. So in the mid-18th century, so in the, you know, let's just say in the 1700s, there's sort of these two parallel movements in the history of Christianity kind of going on simultaneously. In England, we have what's called the Evangelical Revival. So men like George Whitefield, maybe you've heard his name, the Wesley brothers, John and Charles Wesley, they are sparking this similar revival in England. Now, in America then, we have the Great Awakening, and that is primarily pushed forth by Jonathan Edwards. So in 1739, George Whitefield actually comes to America. So it's one of the primary movers of this evangelical revival in England, comes to America, and he has the opportunity. Edwards knows that he's there, and he arranges to meet him, and they actually get to meet. So Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield meeting together, I can only imagine what, you know, that revival would be like with both of them there. And that's kind of where we really start to see this significant period of revival in America. So to the question of the background for all of this, like why did we need this revival, this period in history? In some ways, you almost see a parallel to today in that cultural Christianity was thriving in the 1700s. That's like kind of a weird thing to say, but you know, there was an agreement called the Halfway Covenant, and that's actually associated with Solomon Stoddard. So remember, Edward's grandfather who pastored this church, it's generally attributed to him. And what the Halfway Covenant did is it said, you don't have to actually be a professing Christian to be a church member or even participate in the Lord's Supper. So that's kind of the standard law of the land in this time. And so you can imagine what churches looked like. You know, if you're telling people you don't actually have to profess Christ, you don't have to be a Christian to be a member of the church, well, you're going to have pews that are filled with non-Christians. And so, you know, this is kind of how I think it's helpful to view Edwards preaching through that lens. I know a lot of, you know, Tony mentioned Sinners in the Hands of Angry God, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. We think it's like very harsh, and you know, all he preached was hellfire and brimstone, which of course some of that is that, but think about who he's preaching to. He's preaching to unregenerate man who need to know what they're truly facing were they to die even in that day. So it's kind of an unfortunate piece of, you know, the church in that day, but I think that kind of sets the background for this Great Awakening. You have men who are sincerely and deeply committed to preaching the word of God, and when you do that to a bunch of people who are not truly saved, that is the result that you expect. That is the power of God through his word to, you know, to convert souls. And so that's kind of what we see in the first great awakening. So in 1741, Edwards preaches Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. I have a distinct memory in high school, I think it was 11th grade, in my textbook, there was a passage from this sermon. Maybe some of you also are nodding affirmatively, or maybe it was just my school. Anyway, I think it's a very common example that gets used even in secular literature of, you know, Puritan writing, is Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And what's interesting is that he did not preach this in Northampton. He preached this in Enfield, Connecticut, which was not even his own church. And so you can imagine preaching a sermon like this to people that, you know, you don't even really know. And I think it, again, just gives this color to what he was really, really hoping to accomplish. Again, it's one of his most famous sermons. If you know anything of Jonathan Edwards, as Tony mentioned, it's, you probably have heard of Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And we'll look at a couple passages from there. So that was in 1741. 1742-43, he's preaching on a number of things. The religious affections is one of those topics, and he has a work that gets published on that. And it was also during this period that Edwards meets David Brainerd. And it was kind of by happenstance even that they were able to meet. And David Brainerd was a missionary to the Native Americans. So again, kind of thinking back into, you know, 1700s American history, kind of, we have the colonies, and then we also have, you know, the interaction with the Native Americans. And so David Brainerd was a missionary to them who tried to, you know, sought to bring the gospel to the Native American tribes. And he, David Brainerd, died in 1747. And 2 years later, 1749, Edwards publishes a biography of David Brainerd. And so again, that's another work that you can read. And we'll talk a little more about just how significant that was. But just know that there's this, yeah, this connection and this influence between Jonathan Edwards and David Brainerd, a missionary of that day. So, yeah.
Uh-huh. Why churches were built with people that aren't Christians? Like, what would have been the motivation at that time to go to church?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a fair question. You know, I think there, I think we, again, kind of even not so much, I guess if we go back maybe even 20 years, which I can't really speak to that because I'm, you know, maybe not old enough for some of that, but even in America where there was this idea where it was just culturally acceptable to go to church, that was just the expectation. That's what you did. And I think you even kind of see that in this time period where there was just this expectation of people going to church. And I think this halfway covenant, you know, the idea even to fill the church and, you know, Solomon's Daughter, there are a number of reasons that this was a good thing that Edwards addresses in his work on this, kind of those counterpoints. But things like, you know, the wheat grows with the tares kind of things, just the idea of getting people into the building and bringing them into this fellowship. And, you know, another thing, Solomon Stoddard viewed communion as a, let's see, I don't know if I want to say salvific, but as a regenerative act. So just even the act of taking communion is part of this, you know, part of your conversion. So when you view it that way, of course you would want people who maybe weren't truly Christians to be part of the church. But, you know, Edwards obviously saw it a little bit of a different way. But I think just, yeah, I think in that day, that was kind of the expectation. And there was really no, help to, you know, write that, to prevent that from happening. And so people just, something that you do and you come in and then you end up, you know, kind of in that position. So I don't know if that helps a little bit, but that's kind of my understanding of that, just a cultural moment in their time. Yeah. Yeah, his grandfather. Yeah. Solomon's Stoddard. Stoddard. Solomon Stoddard. Yeah, sorry, that's a tricky name there, but yeah, that was his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, who was the pastor of the church and then, yeah, took over there. So so let's look at first, kind of to this point of the Great Awakening. Edwards was, commission is the wrong word. He decided to write a letter kind of detailing what was going on during the Great Awakening. What did it actually look like for the people who are in these churches who are experiencing this revival? What was that like? And this is a section from the, I think, not the preface, but from the opening remarks in there. So this is it has all of his stuff has a super long name. The full title of this is A Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God in the Conversion of Many Hundred Souls in Northampton and the Neighboring Towns and Villages in New Hampshire in New England, and a letter to the Reverend Dr. Coleman of Boston. That's the full title of this, so just A Faithful Narrative is sufficient for us. So read this here. He says, these awakenings, when they have first seized on persons, have had two effects. One was that they have brought them immediately to quit their sinful practices, and the looser sort have been brought to forsake and dread their former vices and extravagancies. The other effect was that it put them on earnest application to the means of salvation, reading, prayer, meditation, the ordinances of God's house, and private conference. Their cry was, what shall we do to be saved? How do you respond to these two, you know, marks that Edwards is pointing out in that day that he says were kind of characterizing the spirit of the Great Awakening? Any thoughts on any reactions to how he's describing people?
Sounds like a lot of people are being saved.
Yeah, for sure. Would you? I mean, are these biblical marks of salvation? You think? Is this something that we would be right to look for in our day in conversions? Just some things to think about. I think the Great Awakening has this, this air of, sweeping revival, which it was. And I think when we see the way it's described, I think it just is a moment for us to step back and think, when we see conversions, are they characterized in the same way that they were in that clearly, sweeping move of God in church history? So I think it can be helpful even just to kind of think about what that looked like. Absolutely, that's a great point, a great comparison. All right, here we are, we're to the point, we have to talk about sinners in the hands of an angry God. And it is actually, again, it's another one of those things, if you find it, do read it, because it is very it's very helpful to read the whole thing, but I want to try to at least give a little piece of what's in there. Sorry about the microphone. So again, the text for this sermon was Deuteronomy 32:35. And Deuteronomy 32:35, vengeance is mine and recompense for the time when their foot shall slip, and the day of their calamity is at hand, and their doom comes swiftly. So that's quite a passage, and I think it's helful. He even begins, Edwards begins in recognizing, like, this was a curse or a promise of God to Israel for their disobedience, kind of setting it in the biblical context. And then he goes to, expand on that even more. But really, it goes to great length to explain the state of unregenerate man. Namely that he's under the wrath of God, justly. He is only kept from that wrath by God's grace, and that he really can do nothing about that in and of himself. I mean, that's kind of like the Cliff's Notes of his point here. And so I tried to remember if this was like the passage that came to mind, but again, when he writes here, the God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else. Yea, there is nothing else that is to be given as a reason why you do not this very moment drop down into hell. Why? Yes, it to our ears, that's like, that's very, very harsh. Why do you think that was such an emphasis in this sermon, or really in that time period? Why is Edwards preaching things like this? Sure. Yeah. Anybody else?
Mm-hmm. It's not about what you can do. Mm-hmm. It's about knowing God and trusting Him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the way to heaven.
Yeah, it's really kind of, I think, what he's trying to do is give this reality check to the people sitting in the pews who really don't even think about this. They think, well, I'm not a Christian, I'm going to church, like, I'm here, you know, with everybody else. And I think he's really trying to emphasize, like, just the true state of the unregenerate man, that he is in this condition again, that you see the callback to spiders even in his, you know, later years. Yeah.
Because, I mean, you asked the question, what could have been the motivation for the preaching?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, would there be a motive? I'm just looking now, what would be the motivation at this time if God placed somebody like Edwards to preach something like this? I mean, pretty much the answer is obvious. Culturally, we are really a downgrade, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But what was it like during his time?
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, outside of, again, just things like the Halfway Covenant and really coming out of the church in Europe, I think those things are, again, just the idea of nominal Christianity, churches, you know, again, filled with people, unconverted people, and then really that reality, once it hit Edwards in his own heart of his own need for salvation and his call, you know, to God, I think that just welled out from him. He sees all these people who they don't understand the spiritual reality that God has now given to him. He sees in them that they don't truly know the depths of God's glory because they, you know, choose not to do that. And so I think that's really kind of what wells up in him to spark some of these kinds of sermons and just his revival, his evangelistic emphasis in his preaching. I think it comes from his own heart, sure, but I think the circumstances of the day really were just ripe for somebody like him to really speak to people seemingly for, you know, maybe the first time in a while. So we won't end with this type of passage, though. We will end with this. You have to get to the end of Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God to read something like this. And he says, "And now you have an extraordinary opportunity, a day wherein Christ has thrown the door of mercy wide open and stands in calling and crying with a loud voice to poor sinners, a day wherein many are flocking to him and pressing into the kingdom of God. How awful is it to be left behind on such a day?" I mean, this is I don't know if it's actually literally the last paragraph, but it's at the end. It's in his conclusion. And so, you know, he wants to tell them the reality. This is truly where you're at. If you are unsaved, if you don't know God, this is where you're at. You are hanging over the pit of hell. But today is the day where God, by his mercy, through his son, Jesus Christ, has, as he says, thrown open the door of mercy, thrown the door of mercy wide open, and stands in calling and crying with a loud voice to poor sinners. What do you think? What is Edward's chief concern then? What do you think? In preaching a sermon like this, how does this passage help to explain that his chief concern in preaching, you know, to the people of the day?
It seems like he's concerned a lot about salvation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Answer the call.
Mm-hmm.
It might be there for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Anybody else? Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, today is the day, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and how awful is it to be left behind in such a day, right? There is I totally agree, definitely a sense of urgency in his preaching, which, yeah, is needed now and even today. Yeah.
Back to the context that you made earlier about everybody was going to church and the faithful narrative, that last question, what shall we do to be saved?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And we, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And I think that's why when you start to hear and read of his sermons, of what his preaching was like, that's why you start to see this large growth of conversions, because when he starts to preach on the realities of who they are and what they can do about that, I mean, I think that's, again, it's ripe for the for the picking with people in his day. So, any last thoughts on this kind of Great Awakening period or anything that we've read read? So sort of moving towards the end then of his life, the sort of last period, the 1740s, 1750s, it's kind of, you know, all the last things here. 1748, again, there is this, it was already alluded to earlier. 1748 began with a very difficult season of ministry for Edward. So if you read Ian Murray's biography, this is Edward's, in a letter, Edward's writes this. He says, a very great difficulty has arisen between my people relating to qualifications for communion at the Lord's table. My honored grandfather, Stoddard, my predecessor in the ministry over this church, strenuously maintained that the Lord's Supper is to be a converting ordinance and urged all to come who are not of scandalous life, though they knew themselves one unconverted. I formally conformed to this practice, but I have had difficulty with respect to it, which I have been long increasing till I dared no longer to proceed in the former way, which has occasioned great uneasiness among my people and has filled all the country with noise. So we get to this kind of this tipping point where that's been the practice for a long time. But again, Solomon Stoddard has been not been the pastor for years. And, you know, that was their practice. But as Edwards is saying, he gets to this point where actually, I don't believe that. I can't in good conscience do this anymore with people who are truly unconverted, and yet we're basically giving them this false idea that if you sit with us and you take communion with us, then that's good enough for you. You know, so ultimately Edwards wants to fence the Lord's table and kind of really church membership really just to those who are truly Christians. And I know that we hear that and we're like, well, of course, but just know that's kind of the world that he lived in, is that wasn't the practice. And so he decides in, you know, this time period, 1748, that he's going to, you know, take this stand against that. And so in 1749, he writes another title for us, An Humble Inquiry into the Rules of the Word of God Concerning the Qualifications Requisite to a Complete Standing and Full Communion in the Visible Christian Church. So An Humble Inquiry is the title. But he sets at length, and I read some of this, and I wanted to kind of give us pieces of this, but I have one here, but it's a very detailed account of this is why I believe that church membership and communion is just truly for those who are saved. And then he also then moves to address some of the counterpoints of why it isn't that way, and, you know, kind of how to respond to that. So he writes this in 1749, and unfortunately, you know, this causes quite a bit of stir. And he ultimately, this, you know, again, in this time period, these are Congregationalist churches. So they're, maybe you think more like Southern Baptist with voting and things like that. That's the style of church governance here. And so, you know, he ultimately was voted out of his church. And I have the tally here, 230 to 23. So it's not unanimous, but it's essentially unanimous. So people decide, yeah, we aren't going to do that. We don't want to change the way things are. And so after 20 years of faithful ministry, Edwards is removed as the senior pastor of his church, which is a really sad thing. That's kind of how his end of all that time in Northampton. This is, you know, I can't really do justice to this work. It's just too long. And but this is from the preface. So again, it's kind of echoing that same sentiment. I have formerly been of his opinion, being Stoddard, his opinion, but the difficulties and uneasiness on my mind increasing as I became more studied in divinity and as I improved in experience, this brought me to closer diligence and care to search the scriptures and more impartially to examine and weigh the arguments of my grandfather, by which means after long searching, pondering, viewing, and reviewing, I gained satisfaction, became fully settled in the opinion that I now maintain. What is this kind of, how does this shed light on Edward's approach to ministry? What do you pull out of what he's saying here in this introduction? Before he even gets into all that stuff, what does this tell us about Edward's approach to ministry?
It's not just a whim. He's really,
yeah.
It seems like he's really studied and reflected and prayed.
Mm-hmm.
Taken a lot of time over this.
Yeah. And if you look at the book, you would also agree with that. It's very detailed, very thick. Yeah, absolutely. Anybody else? Yeah.
He's unwavering from the truth.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, when I see, this brought me to closer diligence and care to search the scriptures, right? That is where he's looking. He's not looking to the people who came before him. Not that that's necessarily wrong, but ultimately he wants to search the scriptures to see impartially what they teach about this. Yeah. Anybody else? So so he pours all of his effort into this work. It's published. it's read and distributed somewhat, but ultimately people, they just, they don't buy it. They don't agree. And in that, again, that setting, he's ultimately voted out. And so he preaches his last sermon on June 22nd, 1750. June 22nd, 1750. And the text that he preaches on, 2 Corinthians 1:14, which says, "Just as you did partially understand us, that on the day of our Lord Jesus, you will boast of us, as we will boast of you." And so there are, you know, I'm just trying to even think of myself, so many things that you could say. If you think about, you're a pastor, you've been voted out by your congregation, they don't want you there. So many things that you could have on your mind to say to them as you leave. But man, you should really read this sermon with that context, his farewell sermon, because ultimately, you know, what he's emphasizing from that passage in 2 Corinthians is that, you know, he's going to meet his people again. In this life, he is being sent out and away, and he maybe never will see any of them ever again. But the reality is he will stand with them again on that final day. And, you know, when they stand before the Lord, all will be made right. All will be made known. You know, there isn't this sense, I don't get this sense that it's snarky or bitter or angry. He really is just trying to bring back to their minds that, yeah, there is a day where, you know, all of this will be made known and reconciled. And he says, "But when they shall meet together at the day of judgment before the tribunal of the great judge, the mind and will of Christ will be made known, and there shall no longer be any debate or difference of opinions. The evidence of the truth shall appear beyond all dispute, and all controversy shall be finally and forever decided." Just this idea, you know, I think of all the things rolling around in his mind of trying to sort things out, I think he's basically just saying humbly, you know what? There will come a day where it will all be sorted, but it won't be sorted by me. It will ultimately be sorted by God. And this, 2 Corinthians 1:14. Yeah. And then this last one, this is kind of, again, how he ends the sermon. I don't know if it's exactly the last paragraph, but towards the end, he says, "May God bless you with a faithful pastor, one that is well acquainted with his mind and will, thoroughly warning sinners and wisely and skillfully searching professors, and conducting you in the way to eternal blessedness. And let us all remember and never forget our future solemn meeting on the great day of the Lord, the day of infallible decision and of everlasting and unalterable sentence. Amen." It's just, just thinking about the way his ministry concludes like this. I mean, he is clearly, even in that moment, concerned with his people. You know, he's saying, "I hope you find a pastor who truly will continue to lead you to God." And I think there's just, there's something really, really special about even that. So our time is quickly dwindling, but I have caught up to my time marks here. So just a couple of last concluding thoughts, and then we'll get things wrapped up. So just concluding thoughts and, you know, how Jonathan Edwards' influence permeates through church history, even still to today. 1754-55, he publishes a couple of other really well-known works. In 1750, when he leaves Northampton, he goes to Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and he, you know, does some ministering there, but also he begins some missionary work to Native Americans, again, following in the footsteps of David Brainerd. 54-55, he publishes two works, so the first being, here's another one, "A Careful and Strict Inquiry into the Modern Prevailing Notions of That Freedom of Will, which is supposed to be essential to moral agency, virtue and vice, reward and punishment, praise and blame." So the freedom of the will is what you maybe know it by. And you may start to think, well, there's another freedom of the will in church history written earlier, a few hundred years earlier, by Erasmus. And it's basically saying, like, well, we do have free will. We can do whatever we want. This is a different perspective on that. He's not saying, you know, the freedom of sinners to choose God. That's not consistent with his theology in general. What he's saying is that sinners ultimately have limited free will with respect to the absolute free will of God. So sort of this compatibilism idea of how those two things come together. So he also writes The End for Which God Created the World. I read that, and we really couldn't get into it much, but it's a really interesting question to think, why did God create the world? You're probably already spinning around in your minds, well, this and this. And so if you want to know what Jonathan Edwards thought about that question, definitely would encourage you to read that. So in 1757, he's called to be the president of the College of New Jersey. So Princeton, modern today. And so he arrives in February of 1758, and at that time there is a smallpox epidemic going on. And so he receives his smallpox inoculation in February. And unfortunately, because of medical advances at that time, he contracts smallpox and he dies a month later in March of 1758. So it's a very unfortunate even end there to even his life. So he's trying to, you know, get this inoculation for a deadly disease, and yet it turns around and, you know, he ends up dying a month later. And that is not at all a comment on, you know, any modern medicine, but that's just the reality of the day, is kind of that's how he ended his life. But even still, Edwards had a very significant influence on the modern missions movement, which comes in the next 100-ish years. So again, David Brainerd was a missionary. Edwards wrote his biography. Okay, David Brainerd's biography influenced William Carey, and William Carey is a very well-known missionary to the Indians of India. And so you kind of see this chain, even of Jonathan Edwards' work influencing down, and I mean, even today, missionary work in this era is influenced by the modern missions movement, guys like William Carey and all of that work that went along in the 18th and 19th century. So we're also, I have to mention it too, so we're blessed by the ministry of John Piper. If you have listened to John Piper, read anything by him, Jonathan Edwards was a significant influence on his life and ministry. And I think he has kind of made him alive today, even more so through his own works. So if any of this was interesting to you, if you want to know more, the works of Jonathan Edwards, there's a Banner of Truth edition that you can get. It's two giant books. It has everything, basically everything that he has written that's available. I would recommend those to you. There is a biography by Ian Murray, which is the one that I read, which Jonathan Edwards, a new biography. I think the more classic biography is by Marsden. I can't remember his first name. It's about Jonathan Edwards. That is also a very good one. And then, yeah, so God's Passion for His Glory is a book by John Piper. And what he did is he interacts with the end for which God created the world, and then also just publishes the whole text of it again. So if you wanted to just get one piece by Jonathan Edwards, you could do it through God's Passion for His Glory. And Piper also really helps you work through it. He says, you know, if you can't read the whole thing, you should read this, this, and this. And that can be very helpful too. So, two quotes to end the class, and then, you know, because I don't want to end with Jonathan Edwards is dead. So just two things here. First being in a letter from Sarah Edwards, so from his wife to their daughter, after she learned of the death of her husband. It's in Ian Murray's biography. She says, "What shall I say? A holy and good God has covered us with a dark cloud. Oh, that we may kiss the rod and lay our hands on our mouths. The Lord has done it. He has made me adore his goodness that we had him so long. But my God lives, and he has my heart. Oh, what a legacy my husband and your father has left us. We are all given to God, and there I am and love to be." I think it's just just imagining her life and just, you know, responding to the death of her husband, and that's what ultimately comes out. Just the idea of, but my God lives, you know, and we are all given to God, and there I am and love to be. I think it just really emphasizes how Edwards even preached, even to his family. And then, yeah, this is from John Piper again. It's a fitting to end with a quote from him just because of his influence. And so just to read this from God's Passion for His Glory. "My own judgment is that from generation to generation, giants like Edwards are needed to inspire us to think about our faith and to guard us from settling superficially on small ideas about a small God. We need Edwards to waken us from our pragmatic stupor of indifference to doctrine and worship and prayer and evangelism and missions and church planning and social action. Edwards helps us to recover truth because he never loses sight of the unspeakable reality of God, where truth originates, in whom it exists to serve." And yeah, so I just think this is such an encouragement for us of why, you know, what good Edwards still even does to this day, just to kind of encourage us to seek him for that reason, because he just, again, he never loses sight of the unspeakable reality of God. So any last thoughts, comments? Yeah.
So the Great Awakening, is it specifically people being saved and coming to Christianity, or is it more specifically people moving away from Catholicism and moving to an evangelical?
That's a good question. So the Great Awakening in America is a revivalistic movement of the conversion of unregenerate people to the Christian faith. Yeah. That's kind of what's in view in, you know, 1700s America, is more that. Yeah. Anybody else? All right. Well, I'll just close this in prayer again. So let me do that quickly here. Lord, again, just thank you for providing us the example of the life and ministry of Jonathan Edwards for us to reflect on, to meditate on, to think through. I'm just so grateful for his commitment to you, to making your glory known in his day and even now in ours. Lord, just pray that we might reflect and think through his writings, his life, his ministry, the example he's left for us. Pray that that would move us forward to continue to imitate that and to ultimately seek your glory in all the things that we do. Pray even as we go out now to head into our worship service this morning that you would orient our minds and hearts to you, that we might ultimately see that glory even this morning through our time together. Lord, thank you for the many mercies that you've shown us. We're thankful most of all for your son, Jesus, and we pray these things in his name. Amen. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah.
Do you have your slides posted?
I don't, because we don't actually have like a good spot to put those yet, but we're working on that. I can send them to, if anybody's curious about them, I can send them. Or actually, we're working on getting them attached actually to the audio. So that's what I'll do. When it gets posted to the website, I'll attach it there to the, yeah.